Good morning. Did you ever feel like this guy? Well, you wouldn't, Bert, but some of us might. The guy on the left there, he's the Christian, and he doesn't know what to say to this guy. This guy's asking him questions. Where did Cain get his wife? Where do you suppose Cain got his wife? He married his sister. What's the big deal? They weren't inbreeding yet at that time. Their genetic makeup had all the genes they needed, so no big deal. Adam and Eve have a belly button? Don't know and don't care. God could have made them anatomically correct, or he could have left it off, you know? Yeah, who cares? Now we get to the tough ones. How can the earth be young when carbon 14 says rocks are billions of years old? How can we see light from stars that are billions of light years away if we have a young earth? Wouldn't it take billions of years for that light to get here? How can a man live to be 930 years old? We'll cover that when we come to the flood. And where's your evidence for Noah's flood? We'll cover that at Noah's flood, too. But I wanted to give you today just some answers to these questions. People say that to you. You know, you witness the gospel, and they'll ask you a question like this. Where did Cain get his wife? What has that got to do with a dead man getting up out of the grave 3 days after he died? Doesn't, but it will stop someone from listening to your gospel presentation. So I just want to give you some answers. What can you say to these people? People who say, I've studied this issue from both sides, and I've come to the conclusion that evolution is true. Well, if evolution is true, there's no Adam, there's no original sin, there's no need for Christ to die on the cross. This impacts the very gospel. Remember, last week, I gave you the arguments for a young earth. I started with our point of view, and then this week we're going to look at the other side and see what we can say about that. And I'll say one thing first. Neither one of us can prove we're right. Not our side or not their side. This is not science, it's history. And history is not determined in the laboratory. History is determined by eyewitness accounts. We have an eyewitness account of the creation, and that's God Himself. And I personally believe that chapter 1 of Genesis was written by God Himself. I think in chapter 2, verse 4, that Adam took over and wrote. But I think chapter 1, that's just my opinion. You know, Moses put this all together, and he's the one that put it down so we could put it in the Bible. But that doesn't mean he didn't have sources. And of course, he was led by the Holy Spirit. Last time we looked at the young age indicators, helium retention in the Precambrian zircon crystals. Those are the oldest rock. Precambrian is the oldest rock in the geologic column. It's clear at the bottom. So the evolutionists say that rock should be in the millions to billions of years old. So after millions and billions of years, all the helium should have leaked out of it, because helium leaks out of rocks. It doesn't stay in them. And yet, we find there's still helium in those rocks. Those rocks that are supposed to be 4.5 billion years old. Well, the helium should have leaked out a long time ago, and according to the leakage we get now, about 6,000 years, there should have been no helium left. And you can't put helium back into Precambrian granites. It doesn't go back in. So that's a good argument for a young earth. It's hard evidence. It's not proof, but it's hard evidence. We have helium in the earth's atmosphere. Should be a lot more than there is. About 15,000 years for helium to leach out into the atmosphere. Polonium halos formed in Precambrian granite. Now, if you weren't here last week, this is going to seem very strange to you, but you could get the tape if you're interested. Polonium is a radioactive material that has a half-life of from like 14 milliseconds to 384 days or something like that. Just a day. So in seven half-lives, it should be gone. We find these halos in Precambrian granite. Well, the evolutionists say it took millions of years for that granite to harden. It was molten at first. Well, if it took millions of years to harden, how could a polonium halo form in it? It couldn't. It would be a liquid environment, and those halos wouldn't be there. It's impossible. And even the scientists, the guy that did this research, and I have his name from last week, the scientist said, you know what? His observations are absolutely correct. But his conclusions must be wrong because the Earth is 4.5 billion years old. That's good science. Uranium halos in Precambrian granite. Now we're going the other way. U-238 is a uranium isotope that has a half-life of 4.5 billion years. We find uranium halos with no U-238 left. Where'd it go? It couldn't have decayed because that's only one half-life. It takes at least seven half-lives to decay away. So U-238 decay must have been faster at one time than it is now because those halos are there with no measurable U-238 in them. Those are young rocks. Those rocks that the scientific community calls Precambrian and says are billions of years old aren't. High-pressure oil wells, that dates the Earth at about 10,000 years. That's why we have gushers, because there's gas trapped in these caverns with oil. And when you look at the rocks around those oil pockets, they're very porous. And the gas should have leaked out long time ago. And this says if there's still gas in those porous pockets, then the Earth can't be older than 10,000 years. Now, that's our point of view. It doesn't prove the Earth is young, but it's hard evidence for it. We have some good, strong arguments and good, hard evidence. Now let's look at the other side. And this is going to be probably the most technical class I teach in Genesis. So if you're not technically inclined, you might want to turn off your hearing aid or plug in your iPod or something. But I just want to give you some answers to that first guy on that first slide that says, you know, carbon-14 dates these rocks at millions of years old. Billions of years is the God of evolution. Now, I'm going to ask a question. Why are billions of years so important to the evolutionists? Why do you suppose that is? You know, evolution didn't start with Charles Darwin. It started much earlier than that with two guys named James Hutton and Charles Lyell. They're the ones that came up with the billions of years thing. What they did is they observed the strata. You know, like you go to Grand Canyon and you see the lines, the strata, they call those, of the rock. And they say, boy, those must have piled up slowly over billions of years. Well, Darwin took hold of that. And why did he do it? Because there's only one way to have a good case for evolution, and that is to move it outside of the laboratory, to move it to some place where it can't be tested, like billions of years. You know, if there was a young Earth, we should still be seeing evolution in progress. So the evolutionists have to have that 4.5 billion years. They need it to get it outside the laboratory. Darwin raised pigeons, and Darwin never once raised a pigeon that laid an egg that hatched a lizard out, because pigeons lay pigeon eggs. So he knew that he had to get this outside the laboratory, and the only way to do that was to make it a long time, because in another 100 million years, who's going to care what he said? You know, he doesn't have to worry about that then, only for his lifetime. So it's out of the laboratory. It's not science anymore. Now it's religion. Now, evolutionists have three major areas of argument for the billions of years. And these are the major ones. First one is the size of the universe. They say, look, there's a star out there. It's 4 billion light years away. That means the light took 4 billion years to reach Earth, and yet we can see it. So that means that the Earth is 4 billion years old, right? We'll get to that. Radiometric dating methods. This is one of their favorites. Did you know that rocks don't come with birth certificates? They don't have marked on them when they were created. So scientists have to figure it out. And this is one of the favorites and one of the most misunderstood dating methods that science uses for their billions of years. And the last one, of course, is the geologic column. That is the column of lower life forms to higher life forms. And we're going to touch on that just briefly this morning, and then we'll look at that at the flood, because the flood explains the geologic column. It explains it very well. In fact, when you look at the geologic column, you don't see slow sedimentation. You see catastrophism. You see giant fossil graveyards. And you know, it takes very special conditions for fossils to form. Now, we lived on an acreage up in Nebraska, and one night a deer got hit by a car. That deer came and died on our lawn 2 terraces down, so we couldn't see it. And the guy that hit it came up to the door and, I hit a deer out there in your yard. He was so wasted he could hardly talk. But anyway, we didn't see that deer for 3 days. You think that deer would have fossilized if it laid there long enough? You know what? The coyotes had already started on it. Bacteria start on it. Things don't fossilize normally. Erosion, bacteria, predation, all of those things tend to make things that die not fossilize but return to dust. But I'm getting ahead of myself. How can the Earth be young when carbon-14 says rocks are billions of years old? That's the one we're going to hit now. How can that be? We have a carbon-14, you know, I mean, Katie Couric says it. Can't be wrong. I used to say Dan Rather, but he's lost favor. Now, in order to measure first, I misspoke. First, we're going to look at the size of the universe argument. The star is 4 billion light years away. It took 4 billion years for that light to get here, right? And they measure this, they have to measure the speed of that galaxy. And they use this on galaxies, and they use the Doppler effect, the redshift, they call it. Now, what does all that mean? You know what the Doppler effect is, right? In sound waves. Let's pretend this red dot here is emitting a sound, and it's moving towards this guy and away from that gal. See how the sound waves compress as it moves towards the guy and how they expand as it moves away? Well, sound waves are measured in what? Frequency, right? So he's getting the sound waves more frequently than she is. So he's going to hear a higher frequency sound as this moves towards him, and she's going to hear a lower frequency sound. Musicians, am I right? Right, okay. Let me give you an example. That's a car driving by with its horn on. Did you notice how the frequency, the pitch of the sound changed? The pitch from the source didn't change, but the pitch from the observer did, because as it comes forward, those sound waves get crunched together and the pitch goes up and then it goes back down again as the sound recedes. Okay? That's simple, right? That's in sound. Now, you know what? Same thing is true of light. Here's the light waves. Anything that has a waveform will have this effect, this Doppler effect. Here's the visible spectrum. As things come at you, they move towards blue and finally to ultraviolet. And as they go away, they turn red and get to infrared. So you'll say, okay, I can stand on a street corner then, and if a car comes towards me, his headlights should turn blue as they come forward me, right? Well, the thing is, light travels so darn fast that we can't detect that with our naked eye. I mean, we can't detect a Doppler effect in light waves with our naked eyes looking at cars. So don't expect if somebody's running at you with a light that the light gets bluer as he comes closer, because it's just too quick. But we can measure that shift in the billions of miles. So the shift goes to red because those stars are going away from us. And they call that the Doppler red shift. And they measure the speed of galaxies that way by saying, you know, how much has this shifted from regular red to more red as that galaxy is going away at tremendous speeds? So that's how they measure the distance of galaxies. That's the Doppler redshift. Now we're going to get into the theory of relativity. Redshift must measure the speed of galaxies to give distance. So we can't know how far those things are away unless we measure that redshift and get a speed. Well, there's a problem with that. If we apply it across the board, there are some galaxies out there moving at 1,000 times the speed of light. And Einstein proved that matter cannot exceed the speed of light. That can't be. It's impossible. So how do you explain that? How do the evolutionists explain it? Well, here's an example of relativity. And this is a really hard concept for us because we don't think in these terms at all. We think of space as being a static thing and that the galaxies are expanding out into it, you know, as they move out. But that's not true. Space is dynamic. Galaxies expand with the space. So their relative position to us hasn't changed in the space. The space just got bigger. Okay? So if they're close down here and we can see the light from them, as they move out, space moves out with them, and you know, the light just stretches. It doesn't break. So we can have galaxies a billion miles away, and you can't measure that with the redshift because that moved with the space itself. You know, the other problem is if some galaxies, the look-back time, or the time it would take for light to get from there to Earth, would be over 16 billion years. Well, if the Earth is only 4.5 billion years old, how do you explain that if the universe was all from one big bang? Well, you can't explain that. One last thing about this, and I realize this is really hard to grasp for us, because we think in Newtonian physics, we don't think in relativity. But space itself can expand as fast as it wants. It can go faster than light. So our relative position hasn't changed in this good. And this is how science teachers teach it. They put dots on a balloon and they blow up the balloon, and as the balloon gets bigger, the dots move farther apart. Well, that's okay if you explain that there's not a universe, a space to fill, but the space is going with it. Okay, I've got you all confused now. And this is hard, like I say, it's hard to understand. And you know what? That red shift in those stars has never even really been proved to be the Doppler effect. It's just the only thing scientists can think of right now. Now, it may be. I don't know. But I'll tell you one thing. One scientist put it this way. He said, the theory of general relativity saves the Big Bang, but it also means that distance does not equal time light takes to travel. You can't say that if a star is 4 billion light years away that it took 4 billion years for that light to get here because of relativity. There's another easier way to explain this, and this may be the mechanics of how God created his universe, because, you know, when we were talking about it before, I said God created the stars to be lights in the sky for man. Well, he wouldn't place them out there if we couldn't see them, right? So he might have put them there with an appearance of history that they didn't even have. Just like the wine. When the wedding party ran out of wine, what did Jesus do? Here's some grape seeds. Hurry up, go plant them. I'm going to supernaturally make them grow, and I'm going to supernaturally make them turn into wine. You know, no, he just turned it into wine instantly. And that wine had a history, apparent history. There were no grapes that were ever grown for that wine. There were no people that ever processed it from grape to wine. It just had an appearance of a history it didn't have. Look at Psalm 104. Before we leave this, and I'm sorry about this, but I just wanted to touch on these. So if somebody tells you about, well, how can we see stars billions of miles away, say, well, Einstein proved that Doppler redshift can't measure the distance of stars. That's all you have to say. They won't know what you're talking about. Psalm 104:2. It says, covering yourself with light as with a cloak, stretching out heaven like a curtain. Stretching it out. Does that go along with that? Kind of does. I mean, I'm not saying this proves anything, but what it does prove is that Doppler redshift can't be used as a tool to measure how long the light took to get from that planet or that galaxy. That's all I'm saying. Can't be used. And even the scientists say that now. But, you know, our problem is we have so many old science books out there. I was talking to somebody, Joel, was it you, where the science book still had the embryonic recapitulation to show evolution? And that's been proved it was a hoax. The guy used dog fetuses, he used pig fetuses, anything that would fit his purpose in showing that the fetus goes on one stage of evolution to another. He made that up. It's bogus, and yet you still see it in science books because the science books are old. So we have to argue about things that have been proven bogus, just like the missing link, the Piltdown man. Somebody took an orangutan skull and put a human jawbone on it. Or was it the other way around? I don't remember, but it was a hoax. He made it. He threw it in the pit where they were digging, and boy, we had a missing link. Just like that. People believed that for years. In fact, Leakey, the guy that found it, when the guy that admitted he made this hoax, he said, it was a hoax, I made it myself and put it there. He wouldn't believe him. He still kept looking for the rest of the body of this guy. I mean, that's how committed they are to their religion. I mean science. No, I don't. I mean religion. Okay, radiometric dating methods. Now we'll get to these. Carbon-14 is the one you hear about mostly, and it's abbreviated that way. What all that means is that the atoms in this carbon weigh 14 times as much as hydrogen atoms. That's where they get that 14, carbon 14. Most people who ask about carbon 14 usually want to know about radiometric dating methods that are claimed to prove the Earth is billions of years old. And I've even heard that on television before. You know, carbon 14 dating has shown this fossil to be 3.5 million years old. That's bogus. It's impossible. Carbon 14 cannot be used to date rocks. It can only date living things or things that were once alive. Now, carbon dating only goes back for thousands of years, not millions or billions. 50,000 years is the absolute maximum you can date back with carbon 14. 50,000 years. Carbon comes in several kinds. Carbon 14 atoms are radioactive. That means they decay, they lose their energy, and as that energy is lost, they change from carbon back to nitrogen. So they're radioactive. Now, normal carbon, that's carbon 12, doesn't decay. That's the kind we find mostly in our atmosphere. Okay? A lot of creationists use the argument of equilibrium. And they'll say that NASA data shows that equilibrium is not complete yet. Now, here's what I mean by equilibrium. Imagine a barrel, and this barrel is full of little holes all the way up and down it. You take a hose and you start pouring it in the barrel. Okay? As the water rises, it starts leaking out the holes. Okay? Equilibrium is when the water going in equals the water going out, so that it stays at the same level. You see that? Well, scientists say that the carbon 14 that's coming into the atmosphere is equal to that which is decaying in dead plants and animals, so there's equilibrium. Well, NASA shows that there's only 75% equilibrium. So that means that our dates are skewed because they're based on the relationship of carbon 14 to carbon 12 in the atmosphere compared to the carbon 14 to carbon 12 in the sample, because carbon 12 does not decay, but carbon 14 does. So if they get a ratio in the sample and test it with the ratio of the atmosphere, they should be able to date that sample. How does carbon dating work? Well, carbon 14, that's the radioactive one, is made when cosmic rays knock neutrons out of atomic nuclei in the upper atmosphere. How's that for doctrine? I'm sorry. I got to keep this light. This is really heavy stuff. But it makes sense if you think about it. It really does. Carbon 14 is made when cosmic rays hit atomic nuclei and knock the neutrons out of it. Now, these neutrons move very rapidly towards the Earth, and they hit nitrogen at lower altitudes, and they convert that nitrogen then to carbon 14. That's how carbon 14 is formed. That's how it gets into the atmosphere. It's caused by cosmic rays from the sun. Okay? Carbon 14 combines with oxygen to give carbon dioxide. Only it's carbon 14 dioxide, not carbon 12. Most of the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is regular carbon and two oxygen atoms, but this is the same. It's carbon dioxide. So it's taken up by plants and animals. It's taken up by plants because plants need carbon dioxide, and they put out oxygen. They're the opposite of humans. Humans breathe oxygen and exhale carbon dioxide. Plants are just the opposite. They breathe, so to speak, carbon dioxide and exhale oxygen. So that's a good source of oxygen is plants. Anyway, this carbon 14 dioxide is taken up just like the regular carbon dioxide in plants and animals. And animals eat the plants, they get the radioactive carbon. So as soon as the animal dies, then what happens? Or the plant? As soon as that plant dies, the carbon 14 is still decaying because it's radioactive and it's not taking in any more regular carbon dioxide because it's dead. So the ratio drops. There gets to be less carbon dioxide with carbon 14 than carbon dioxide with the regular carbon or carbon 12. You see? Because it's decaying, it's radioactive. So if they measure that ratio between the ratio and the atmosphere, then and if you know the half-life of carbon 14, then you should be able to date that object, right? Seems pretty straightforward, pretty simple. There's two things to remember. Carbon dating only works on something that was once alive, so don't ever let Katie Couric tell you that they dated a rock with carbon 14, because rocks don't eat and they don't breathe, so they don't get carbon dioxide. After 50,000, that's a max. A lot of people say 30,000 years. But after 50,000 years, all that carbon 14 should be gone. It should have decayed completely. So you can't, that's why you can't go back after 50,000 years. So if an animal died a million years ago, his carbon 14 was gone after 50,000 years. So you can't go past that. It won't tell you anything. It's not quite that simple, though. That was the simple explanation. Now we're going to get complicated. No, it's not really complicated. First, some plants discriminate against carbon dioxide that contains carbon 14. They won't take that kind of carbon dioxide. They only want the pure carbon dioxide. That skews your results when you're measuring that plant. That makes them test older than they really are because they didn't take in as much carbon 14. So they'll say a plant like that completely discriminated. You can dig it up 2 days later and test it, and it'll say, well, it's got to be over 50,000 years old because all the carbon 14 is gone. Well, that plant never took carbon 14 because it discriminated. So that makes measuring this a little more difficult than it would seem on the surface. The ratio of carbon 14 and carbon 12 in the atmosphere isn't constant. So if you measure the ratio in the test with the ratio in the atmosphere, you're taking one time chunk in the atmosphere. Might have been different at another time. In fact, the industrial age has to be taken into account, because the industrial age has belched out tons of carbon dioxide that has no radioactive isotopes in it. It's all straight carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. The amount of cosmic rays affects the generation of carbon 14. So that's a variable. Now think of what the Genesis flood would have done to carbon 14. Now, if you believe the vapor canopy theory, like I do, then the whole earth was lush vegetation before the flood, and a lot more plants than there are now, and then you have this giant catastrophe, it would have skewed everything. Volcanoes, another source of carbon dioxide depleted in radioactive isotopes. So it's not quite so simple as that hose in the barrel, you know, because the hose might slow down part of the time, and somebody might come along and poke some more holes in the barrel, or somebody might walk by and dump a bucket of water in the barrel. You see what I mean? You can't trust that. There are too many variables. So carbon 14, up to 50,000 years, and even that is suspect. And you know, there are many anomalies in carbon-14. Even scientists don't like to use this anymore. R.H. Brown, in his article, Correlation of Carbon-14 Age with Real Time, in the Creation Research Quarterly, 1992, determined, he radioed carbon-dated a muskox that was found in Alaska, frozen. And guess what they found? They found that this muscle of this musk oxen was 24,000 years old, and his hair was 17,000 years old. So either he had a really old toupee on, or something's wrong with this system. I mean, the same sample, the hair and the muscle dated different. What's the matter? It doesn't work. There's too many variables. This one just killed me. Ground sloth cave dung. There are people who study ground sloth cave dung. I kid you not. How would you like to be a child? My dad studies ground sloth cave dung. He wouldn't make it through grade school, probably. Anyway, if you use standard carbon dating on these dung pellets, you'll find the carbon dates of the lower layers suggest that the sloth produced 2 pellets a year. Now, that is one constipated animal, I want to tell you. 2 a year. It doesn't work, folks. There's just too many anomalies in it for it to be anything accurate of a dating method. You can't calibrate the clock. There's no way to do it. They tried tree rings. That didn't work. There's just no way to calibrate it. So it's all over the place. Now, other radiometric dating methods are the kind that use decays of parent and daughter products. For example, potassium 40 decays, you know, the radiation goes away, it expends energy, and it turns into potassium 40. Uranium 238 decays into lead 206 via other elements. Uranium 235 decays into lead 207. So you would think, okay, we know the half-lives of these elements, and we know what they turn into after they have expended this radiation. So if there's this much uranium-235 in an object and this much lead-207, and we know the half-life of the 235, then we can compute when that rock was created, right? Because it decays at a predictable rate, and it turns from uranium to lead. Now, stop and think about this. You're walking down the street, and this is how all the radiometric methods work. You're walking down the street, and you see a swimming pool, and in this swimming pool is a 40-foot ice cube. You say, wow, that's pretty cool. I never saw a 40-foot ice cube before. So you go over to the swimming pool, and you start measuring the water in the pool, and you measure it for 3 hours, and the water goes up 1 gallon. So you can determine when that ice cube was put in that pool, right? No. What if there's already water in the pool? What if it was sunny yesterday? What if it was cloudy yesterday? What if it rained 3 days ago? Can you possibly determine when that ice cube was put in that pool? That's exactly how these radiometric dating methods work. It assumes some things. It assumes, one, that the starting concentrations are known. You know how much lead was there to begin with and how much uranium. If you don't know that, how can you date it? They assume it was all uranium. Well, no, there's no basis for that assumption. They just assume it. Decay rates have been constant. That's an assumption they make too. Well, we looked at U-238, was it, that with the uranium halos, that half-life has changed. The decay rates change. And the decay rates change according to outside conditions too. And then you have to assume there was no loss or addition of the parent and the daughter products, components. In other words, you have to assume that your sample hasn't been contaminated. Nobody walked by that swimming pool and dipped out some water, or nobody walked by and threw in some water in our illustration. You have to assume that. Look, there's all kinds of assumptions. That radiometric dating, it just doesn't work. There's problems with it. Look, the uranium lead. You know what? Those isotopes, they migrate in rocks. They leave. They go away. So how do you know what the sample was to start with? How do you know some of this didn't decay, it just left? You don't. Lead vaporizes at very low geothermal temperatures. So the lead could vaporize, and you have less lead than the decay provided. Lead isotopes can change when they're bombarded from cosmic sources. So lead we don't want to measure might get mixed in with the lead that we are measuring. That's somebody came in and threw some water in that swimming pool. There's no way to know how much that happened. Potassium argon is another one they use. There's a great one. Argon is a gas. It leaks out of rocks. How are you going to measure that? It doesn't work. Argon can enter rocks from the atmosphere if you have increased pressure and lower temperatures. So you can actually put argon back. And potassium, again, readily dissolved by water. Rubidium, strontium, that's one of the most popular ones today, I think. Same thing, easily vaporized by heat and dissolved by water. Now I'm just going to take some comments from the Encyclopedia Britannica. This is not my words. This is the words of the Encyclopedia Britannica. It says, the physical records used in absolute time measurement leave much to be desired in the way of completeness and clarity. Unfortunately, such checks have painted a generally gloomy picture for those seeking a chronometric tool. The rubidium-strontium method is not without its problems. So, and this is, I tell you, this is the truth. How do they know whether they have a good sample or a bad sample? How do they determine that, if it's been contaminated or not? Do you know how they do it? If it gives them the date they're looking for, it's not contaminated. If it doesn't, that one's contaminated. And that's the truth. That's how they do it. So do you have a little bit of that you can go back at people with? I hope so. Because that's been the whole purpose of this class. It wasn't to stand up and show how smart I am. Like I said, I sweat bullets trying to understand this stuff this week. But it makes sense if you stop and think about it. And if somebody comes up and tells you a rock was dated with carbon-14 and it's been 3 million years old, you can say, you're crazy. You don't know a thing about what you're talking about. Just a little ammo for us to fight back with. Because I don't want the gospel to be ruined by an outside thing like this. You know, this is mundane stuff. But people will bring it up when you talk about the gospel. It really doesn't have anything to do with the dead man getting up out of the grave, but people ask these questions. And we as Christians should at least have some kind of an answer for them, or they won't even listen. And we looked at the geologic columns, and again, as I said, we will look at this more in the flood. That's the Grand Canyon, and you can see the layers in the rocks. You can see how they got the idea that it was formed over long periods of time by slow sedimentation. Could also have been formed by a great flood and a washing back into the ocean. geologic column has abrupt appearances of high-order animals and plants. In other words, you have highly complex organisms appearing abruptly in the fossil record with no evidence of any history. You have unchanged animals. You know what? Most of the animals in the fossil record are unchanged from today. Most of them. Now, you see dinosaurs, of course. You see some things. But most things found in the fossil record are almost identical to what's alive today, by and large. And we have sufficient fossils. Now, birds supposedly evolved from lizards or reptiles. We have millions upon millions upon millions of fossils, and there's not one transitional form. Not one. We have plenty of fossils. We should have transitional forms. There's no transitional forms between the major kinds. That's why they came up with the punctuated equilibrium theory. That punctuated equilibrium simply means that a lizard laid an egg and a pigeon hatched out. Fossilization, as I mentioned before, requires very special conditions. Animals have to be buried fast, and they have to be buried deep for fossilization to occur. Otherwise, predation and bacterial growth and erosion will turn them back to dust before they ever get a chance to fossilize. Again, we'll look at this a little more when we get to the Genesis flood. Father, thank you for your word, and we pray as we look at these arguments for a young earth that we can have some answer to those who would not believe the gospel because they think their science proves that Christianity is wrong. Because we have plenty of evidence, we have plenty of things to say to these people to get them to listen to the gospel. But the most important thing is that they do listen to that gospel and that we do proclaim that gospel, that Christ died for our sins. In His name we pray. Amen.